Okay, we're ready to start. Maybe we could shut that door, eh? My name's Ted Harbach. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm alive and sober today by the very special grace of a loving God and a loving program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to see a show of hands. Are there any newcomers here for less than a year? All right, great. Anybody 10 years or over? God, that's fantastic. Well, if you're anything like I am, you're probably sick and tired of hearing all of the misinformation that's coming from meetings that you attend. And this is one of the reasons that I do this. My sobriety date is April Fool's Day, which is a good day for me. It snuck up on me there. You're sober, April Fool, you know. I'm 1968, so I've been around this program over 24 years. And through the years, it's been my distinct privilege and honor and a gift to have shared the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous around the United States and Canada with the people that I have come to find are the masters of the program, the real guides. And so I've become a guide. And the way a guide finds his way is by stepping on the bodies of those that lost their way. That's just the way it is. You know, you've heard all of the cliches about alcohol being cunning, baffling, powerful, patient, progressive, and terminal. And that doesn't seem to upset us any. Yeah, except for me, right? But you know, there's another curious syndrome that is never talked about. And that's what they call a wet brain, which really isn't a wet brain at all. It's a brain that's been dehydrated by alcohol. What happens is the entire body, what it is a closed circuit electrical system, and without moisture it ceases to work, and it dies. And a number of years ago I was sponsoring a man from Garrett Air Research who was home on medical leave for alcoholism, and he was talking to me reasonably articulately. And he was a little drunky too, because his daughter hadn't gotten home with his din-din. Yeah, honey. And the next day he was in a full care facility, unable to take care of his bodily functions as a result of alcohol. That is alcoholic insanity. And those are the ones that just sit on their porch and rock back and forth and people change their diapers. And you never know which drink is going to do that. Because that's the drink that could really be the end of everything. And that doesn't scare us either. You know, I sometimes stand at the podium and I tell everybody I wish they all had cancer. And that I had 12 magical steps that would cure that. I'd have 101% participation. You know. So, just to bring you up to date with where I've been, in the last 2 years have been probably a roughest years that I've gone through, and either before sobriety or after sobriety, I developed a tremendous resentment against a guy 2 years ago that cheated me. Then I had another little eye surgery, and then I had pneumonia, and that's kind of an inconvenience because you get up after that and suit up ready to show up after breakfast and have to take a 4-hour nap. And then last year people weren't paying too much attention to me, and so I thought, you know, I'll really do some self-pity, so I decided to have a heart attack and a 6-way heart bypass. And I got kind of resentment because I understand they can do 8. I figure if one's good, more's better. And I got to tell you, if it wasn't for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of loving people like you, there'd have been a lot of gun smoke and tears. A lot of it. Because I move right from, I don't know anything about assertive. I move right from firm to combative. And welcome, come on in, sit down, pull up a piece of floor or something. So, like I said, without the program, I would absolutely be lost. And And I never realized how many people cared for me. They just offered their homes for my recovery, and it was incredible. And when the doctor from Riverside Community Hospital, that's out there in the hinterland somewhere, and he came into my chief of cardiovascular surgery, right, the main frame, and he comes in and he perches on the end of my bed, right, and he's got his arms folded and his legs crossed. You know, I know body language. I know the conversation's over before we start. And he said, we've looked at the films and we've looked at all of the tests and we've checked everything. We've decided you're not a candidate for heart surgery and you'd only have about a 35% of survival, and so we've elected not to do surgery. I said, is that all? Well, he said, yeah. I said, well, how long do I have to live if I don't have the surgery? I figure we're in an elective mode right here, you know. A little denial kicking in. And so he said, well, 2 weeks to 2 years, you're living with a time bomb. The main artery to the left ventricle is 98% occluded, and if it closes up, why, that's the end of that. And so I said, well, is that the end of the conversation? He said, yeah. And I said, well, let me tell you a couple of things. See, the biggest problem that we as human beings have in dealing with reality is due to the major fact that is stated in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says lack of power is our dilemma. Why is that our dilemma? Because we so freely give it away. You know, somebody looks at us cross-eyed and we give them all the power. See, I can give somebody so much power over me that they can put me in the electric chair for first-degree premeditated murder. Is that giving power away? You know, because I know assertive. I can give so much power to a person, I can allow someone to get me so angry that I have a cardiac arrest right on the spot. Is that giving power away? So this Huckleberry sitting there on my bed, and I just thought, am I going to give this guy the power? Well, I don't think so. So I said, well, let me tell you a few things, Doc. I said, first of all, you may have gotten an A in appendix, but I said, I think you flunked hard. And I said, secondly, I don't know what gambling casinos you grew up in, but the way the odds play in real life is that you give me the percentages and I make the decision, not you. And I said, thirdly, from where I come from, a 35-40% chance of survival is a sure thing. And I said, fourthly, I said, I need a surgeon with some balls, not one that's covering his ass, and so you're dismissed. And his jaw hit the ground. And then I went out and found a real mechanic that could get the job done, and so by the grace of God and the people of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program, I didn't have to give the power away. I was able to do the footwork that was necessary. The people that loved me, that I never knew about, came to help me. I was supposed to do the First Lake Roosevelt roundup on the date of my surgery. They sent me a 4-foot card with I don't know how many hundreds of signatures on it to get well. And I'm going to take that card back with me the first of October of this year and thank all of those people. So lack of power is our dilemma. And we have the option as to whether to give that power away or not. And it can be a real easy thing for us not to give the power away if we realize that words mean nothing. You know, if you don't believe that, why, find some Norwegian down at the boat dock that just came off the boat and go up to him and use every four-letter word that you know. Every one of them. And he'll just look at you like you're crazy and walk away because he doesn't understand the language. So the words only have the power if we give them the power. I remember I got through speaking one time and some puke came up and he says, you know, you're a real asshole. And I thought about it for just a second. I said, you know, you may be right, and walked off. You know, guess who kept the power? Like somebody came up another time and said, who the hell do you think you are, Ted? And I said, well, when you find out who you are, you won't have to ask that question anymore. And guess who kept the power? See, so What we need to find out here is how that power slips away so easily. And I make a promise to everybody that I sponsor through the steps, and that is what it says in the program, that I can move a person from step one into step nine, pull up a piece of carpet and sit down and make yourself at home. It's all family. There's a lot of room over here. No, I'm sorry. There's two chairs here. Okay. Is there anybody else sitting next to a vacant chair? Raise your hand. Okay, there's some back there. Please don't stand up if there's a chair, okay? And if you want to sit on the floor over here, do that. And I ain't even let you walk in front of the podium. There's a chair over there. And people will say, well, that's impossible to work through them that fast. And yet, if you read this book, which nobody's reading anymore, read Bill's story in the beginning, you know. Read any of those stories of those old-timers. They were out smoking up and down the street making amends the second day. Because, see, that's all they had to hang on to. That's all they hang on to. And what most people don't understand is the percentages in the book that are stated are still true. 50% of the people that come in and really give this a try never have to go out again. But the key in there is, and really give it a try. We have an 8% success rate for continued sobriety up to 5 years, and it goes from 8 to 3% over 10 years. And I know because I've been to hundreds of meetings across the United States, and you watch the countdown. I've checked with the secretaries and the treasurers of the number of chips they buy and give out. You can see the odds. It's just as apparent as can be. And it's tragic because there is no reason why anybody has to go out. And we're making a real, we're giving people that are coming back after little slippy poos, you know. Relapse, I love that. And relapse prevention. Look at all of the signs for relapse. If I saw a sign up for a relapse, I'd already be in it. I mean, you know, I check with a doctor and he says it's a real stressful situation. It's obvious. You're spending too much money doing too much shopping. You're driving too fast. You're drinking too much. You're smoking too much. It sounds like a good day to me. My kind of day, right? So what the hell are they talking about? They don't know what our personalities are like, unless we got 10 things going at one time where it's boring. So don't ever pray for serenity. Never. I promise you, the first day you wake up serene, you'll swear you're in a suicidal depression. There is just nothing going on, man. I mean, your left arm, if you have one, is probably serene right now. And you haven't even thanked it. If you don't believe that it's serene, which we don't, like, go slam it in that door. And it will tell you right away it is no longer serene. People say, God, if I could only be happy. Happy is zero. We're used to high elation or suicidal depression. We don't know if I'm happy. Happy, there's nothing going on. If you want to be happy, it's real simple. Real simple formula. Stop doing the things that are making you unhappy. Yeah, I'm here. Living with some dingbat that's down your throat all of the time after you take your inventory and find out it's her fault or his fault. Like, what, you know. Got a car won't run, blow it up. Take action. So happiness is the absence of anything that is making you unhappy. And that seems rather simple. I'm unhappy because I'm in a financial wreck right now, and so what I have to do is get into something to make some money. So I just changed careers about 3 weeks ago, and we're smoking again, off running. So I've been in the mortgage business for about 8 years, and the mortgage business is so heated up now, I think there's going to be 3 million houses refinanced in the south end of California this year. And it's called wait in line. If all the T's aren't crossed and the I's dotted and everything's perfect, they throw it in the trash bin. And so what we have to do is write about this stuff and find out what's going on so that we can come to a solution. Now, this pamphlet that I handed out is got way more information in it than you need, and so don't worry about it. However, I can make you a promise, and I make a lot of promises because I steal them out of the book. How many people know how many promises there are in the book? I sponsor him. See, the ones that think there are 12 promises in the big book, once again, have shortchanged themselves. There are over 172 promises in the first 164 pages of the big book, and they've all come true for me. And if you don't believe me, read it. We got a guy not too long ago to read the big book, and he wouldn't do it. And so his sponsor said, "God, I just was amazed reading that book about Bill being a homosexual." Some of the people even know who Bill is. That's great. Co-founder, okay. And he came back to his sponsor, and he says, "I couldn't find that anywhere. I read every single page." "It's in there. Read it again." If he ever finds out, we're going to have a dead sponsor. So I can make you a lot of promises. And one promise I can make you unequivocally is this: if you use these first two pages on a daily basis exactly like it is stated, your life will change immediately. Immediately. And we'll go over those things in a little bit, but this is a composite on this second practice of principles in all our affairs. This is a composite of the big book, my personal experience, and the input from a lot of experts. And you can run your whole life off of what is on this first page. And to make sure that you're running your life with what's on that first page, we made a second page, which I would recommend that you have, make yourself about 30 copies for the month. And you're on your way. The second page, the inventory, is exactly out of the big book. And if you're sponsoring somebody, I can promise you this. This will make sponsorship so much easier that you will not believe it. I will not talk on the phone to somebody that calls me unless they have three things in front of them: a pencil, a piece of paper, and the big book. And what they're calling me about had better be written down. And if it's written down, if it's not, I say, "Do you have this written down?" "Oh, well, no, I don't." "Fine, write it down, call me back." And those 10-hour conversations just compact to about 10 minutes. And you will save yourself immeasurable time, and you'll be following the formula in the big book. If at any time anybody has a question, why, please just raise your hand, and we'll interrupt and have crosstalk and throw things. And the next three pages, which are forms. I'm sorry, we're Kill Dick Bowlby. He only had 50 copies made. And these three forms are from Joe and Charlie's workshop from Little Rock, Arkansas, the Big Book Comes Alive seminar, who I believe have presented probably the most honest presentation of the Big Book that I have ever heard. And they do that around 35, 38 times a year. And if you hear about the Big Book Comes Alive seminar coming into your area, why, please see.
My name is Al.
I am.
And
Al has kept in real close contact with Joe and Charlie, and I've been fortunate enough to share the podium with both of them. Back in Little Rock and back in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and they are just fantastic. So I've stolen some of their forms. This one on basic instincts of life, which creates self, this diagram here, is probably the most incredible diagram that I've ever seen. This comes from, and make a note about this, step 4 in the 12 and 12. Now, what happens is, if we have a basic instinct, plan ahead. Our whole, see, we're born with four basic instincts. And if you took a group of kids and you put them on a desert island with no training, no peer group or nothing, they would develop a social group because we are social animals. And sitting right on top of the primordial brain stem, what I call the lizard mind, right, are these basic instincts. And so they would form a social group, a clan, a tribe, something, without knowing why at all. And then they would form something for their basic security, a stockade, a cave, a something, because that's the way we are. And they would begin to procreate sooner or later. The boys would find out that the girls were not just soft boys. And they would begin to procreate. Now, if one of these basic instincts is, and make a note of this, is threatened, or damaged, we have only one basic instinct left, and that is survival. And that survival instinct is really the lizard mind in action. It only knows a couple of things. It knows fight or flight. Fight translates itself, looking at the bottom of this page, into resentment and harm to others, and flight translates into fear, and you have your three basic character defects. Any threat or damage to your basic instincts results in that. Instinctively, we have no defense, you see. No defense at all, thank you. And so we are trapped in the reaction of our basic survival instinct. If any area of our social instinct, our security instinct, or our sexual instinct, if any area is threatened or damaged, in your inventory, well, you'll find out how they are all threatened most of the time. When you get a flat tire and you're standing out there by the freeway like a boob, look what happens. You know, your prestige is threatened, your self-esteem, your pride, who's coming by and going to see me, right? Your ambitions to get wherever you're going to get, your material possessions under security instinct are threatened because the first thing I do is get a hammer out and start pounding on the car, you know. And emotional. And you get so involved with this tyranny of trivia that you'll be shut down sexually for a month. And wonder why, you know, it's the car, you know. So the damage to ourselves when we allow this to happen, this reaction, we allow survival to happen is absolutely incredible. But we've got some defenses against this. So what we have to do is do what the book tells us, be rid of the things that are blocking us. If you want to know how fast this program can work, on page 60 of the big book, right after that part of chapter 5 that's read at every meeting, it says a description of the alcoholic, the chapters of the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we're alcoholic and could not manage our lives. B, that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God couldn't would if he were sought. Not found, just sought. The next sentence is a trigger sentence in the book. It says, being convinced of this, we were at step 3. And I am so sick and tired of hearing people saying, well, I have to do step 1 again, and go get drunk. You know. Don't get screwed up, you know. I mean, I don't understand what they're saying. What book are they reading? You know. If you're here, step one's finished forever. You know. And once you're into recovery, you are no longer powerless over alcohol. And your life will become manageable because the book says we got a new manager, right? We don't have to worry about it anymore. Being convinced we're step three. So people that I'm sponsoring, I ask them, are you convinced of these three ideas? If they say no, then I tell them to go get drunk or read the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters, which are designed to convince you of those three ideas. Then we're at step three. Right now, turn the page over to the middle of 63. There's the prayer for step three. And then you say that prayer, grab somebody by the hand because it says to do that, and you know, get in the bathroom, close the door, and pull the drapes because it's not cool for an alcoholic to be on his knees, you know. Now, let's make a note. Everywhere in the book that it says will, put the word thinking. And it makes it a whole lot easier. In step three, it says, made a decision to turn our will and our life for the care of power greater than ourselves. Or God as we understood him, or whatever it says. And will and life is simply too hard to get a hold of. You know, God as we understood him. So, if we change that to made a decision to turn our thinking and our actions over, I can get a hold of that. Because as step 11 says, we ask God to direct our thinking. So if my thinking can become God-directed, then my life will become, my actions will become God-directed, and my actions are my life. So, end of problem. Will in life is just too hard to get a hold of. So, when it comes to a will, why a guy that has some money that decides to leave it to his heir and issue, so he goes to an attorney and they write out all the distribution of his wealth to be taken care of when he dies. And then he dies and everybody rushes out and gets him buried real fast. And then they rush over to the attorney's office and he reads what that man's thinking was on that day that he made this out, and they call that his will. Any questions? So it gives you a real easy handle on turning your will and your life over. So and Bill says will over and over, and if you replace thinking for that, as in the 11th step prayer, it says we ask guidance of our thinking throughout the day. So, and if anybody finds anything that I'm saying that's not in concordance with the big book, please raise your hand, because it's only in being found wrong that I'm led back to the truth. And so we do that prayer, and then we immediately go to the top of the next page, which is 64, and here is probably the most important trigger sentence in the big book, is at the top of page 64. Write that down on your note. What that says is, though our decision, meaning the decision in step three, was a vital and necessary step, it would have little lasting effect unless followed at once. Now, at once, I looked it up, it means now. Unless followed at once by a searching, fearless, moral inventory. And so we start on the inventory. How much time has passed? About 7 minutes. And we've already got the 900-pound pencil, or in my case, it was a crayon that I had to use so I wouldn't stab myself. Okay? And a roll of toilet paper, because we're going to write the valedictorian of our career here. And remember, please, that the inventory is never finished and it's never perfect. So don't make a big deal out of it. Don't wait for an 8-day Easter weekend and a chateau overlooking Lake Arrowhead and a word processor with a spelling program in it. write the valedictorian of your career, you know. Just do what it says in the big book. Make a list of everybody you're pissed off at. He says resentment because he's gentle. How long is that going to take you? 3 minutes? Five? Then make a list of everything you're afraid of. Another couple of minutes. And then make a list of everybody that you're damaged. And in the fourth step, I combine the seventh step with that list of harms. And so under harms, you can follow this first page that I have here. Have you harmed them physically, mentally, morally, emotionally, financially, socially, or spiritually, or sexually? Okay, in the first list of people you've harmed, put your name first. Put your name. Who'd you harm more? People did to me what I thought about doing to myself. If they thought about doing to me what I did to myself, I'd have killed them. Put your name first on the third list of sexual harms. You know, who harmed, what the things that we did, you know. And don't give me all that stuff, oh, well, I was drunk. Well, of course. That's a big problem with relationships when we get sober. We've never done it sober, you know. So if you guys want a line that'll really work. And believe me, it works. If this gal has the barest modicum of Al-Anonism in it, why, in her, why, you're home free. See? Yeah, all you have to do, of course, I don't know if you can do it because it really takes a lot of honesty and courage. And all you have to do is say, you know, I've never had any experiences sexually sober, and I don't think I'd be any good. There's one that's ready. The whole problem with relationships is that we just can't be honest. Guys come into the relationship with all this macho stuff and think the girl wants to be rescued and all of that crap. All they want is somebody to hold them and to be gentle. You know, don't keep trying to fix everything, you know. And remember this, that honesty without compassion is brutality. And when it comes to the amends, never, ever tell your partner about past experiences. The big book warns us against that. I have seen marriages and relationships destroyed because the guy keeps probing the woman for, well, you know, you must have done this or that and how many times and all that. Or he, in abject misguided honesty, will share with her all of the affairs that he's had and so forth. And I've got to promise you, when the back end meets the front end and an argument stops, that starts, that's going to come right back as mud in your face. I don't know why that is. And it's nobody's business as far as I'm concerned. If I'm having a relationship with a lady, it starts today. And it should be based on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will hear a lot of people say, well, relationships in AA just don't work out. You know why you hear that? It's because we share stuff that no other human beings share. So we hear about that stuff. But I can tell you that I know of many, many, many long-term tremendous spiritually based program based relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe this. I believe that if the relationship is based on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it has a better chance of success in long-term success than a relationship based on anything else that's known in the world today. Because what kind of a deal would it be if each partner were continuing to take personal inventory and sharing it with their sponsor? I don't want to hear that stuff with my lady when I come home. What do we got, a cement mixer in the front yard or in the living room? Well, you should have seen what happened today, you know. It's already running full blast when we get home, and, you know, We're on the deck. We're from on the deck from a hard day of sponsoring. You know, you think you had a hard day? Well, you hear what this crappy had told me, you know. And, you know. So if each one's writing it down, sharing it with their sponsor, and taking care of it, then all you got is the one thing that we've been looking for all of our lives. And that's the lady. I look at a relationship like a little orchestra, and the lady plays in the treble clef, and she plays a neat little instrument, maybe a violin or a piano, and the man, he plays the bass. I can't even read her music because they're written in different clefs. But if we each practice our part and get it as good as we can, then we can put them together in the one thing we've looked for all of our lives, harmony. Not each one playing the damn melody, because that's boring. You know, but harmony. Each one doing their own deal and putting it together. And don't get confused with geometry. Two halves do not make a whole. What you end up with is half a relationship. One of them taking, one of them giving, neither one full or one half empty, the other one half full, nobody's satisfied. What you need is two whole and complete going concerns that are only in that relationship when they meld together while we are together, okay? So what we're looking for is harmony, all right? And if you can do that, you can have one of the greatest relationships within the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that you can possibly imagine. Now, getting back to the, the big book. So we got the three lists now. The reason you make the three lists first is because now you have a framework. And if you don't make the framework first, then you stall out. So then you go back after you got the list on resentment and you write a couple of sentences about that. You know, I'm angry at my mother because she put me on the potty backwards. All mothers do that. They're sick. They want to watch. And they get so happy. Oh, look, baby did poo-poo, you know. God, and you're thrilled, and everybody's wonderful, and a couple of years later, you bring her a little sample and smear it on the wall, and you get a whole different message from them. And that starts the dual messages that we get in childhood, you know. And the fears are rather simple, and in the third part, you write down a couple of sentences about why you're afraid. And I had a terminal fear of height. I couldn't get up on a bar stool without a parachute and a backup. And these are hard to get out. And finally I got back to the fact that my parents never told me, if you're climbing, hold on so you won't fall, which is what I was able to tell my daughter. They said, if you climb up there, you're going to kill yourself. And no wonder I was terrified. In fact, I got laughing hysterically the other day when I was driving up to Arrowhead with a guy that I sponsor, and we stopped, and I had to relieve myself, so it was very, very steep, and so I just thought I'd step off the road, you know, having some class. It's low, but it's class. And as I started off the edge, here's what I heard. Don't fall, and be careful of the snakes. How do you be careful of a goddamn snake? And I started laughing hysterically. I almost fell off the edge of the bus. I came back up, and he said, what the hell were you laughing at? And I said, well, you were doing dad. You know? And I said, giving me the most ridiculous information in the... App totally useless. Not only that, it just jammed some more fear in there. You know. Now, fortunately, because of the program, I was able to stop that spiral with my daughter. And under exactly the same circumstances, I said this because I remember it. Look, honey, as you're going down the edge of that, keep your knees bent, keep your body relaxed, let your feet slide, keep the big bush in reach in case you slip so you can grab a hold of it, so you won't fall, and make plenty of noise so that if there happens to be a snake, you'll get the hell out of your way. And now we end up with a solution rather than the problem. And so we can do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. So getting to the root of those fears is hard. The third part's easy. The third list, we just write what happened. And this is when small farm animals get into the inventory. And mommy and daddy sometimes, because I want to tell you, we are only as sober as our secrets. And I've seen many relationships. My marriage of, I shouldn't really share this from the podium, but my marriage of 16 years was destroyed because of a secret. And there are so many people with so many problems going back into their childhood, rape and homosexual stuff and incest and all of that. And that inventory is designed to take care of all of that. Unless we get that out and make amends to ourselves and excuse ourselves and ask God to help us with that and make amends to the people if possible and heal all of this, why, we don't have a chance. It's just going to keep rearing its head up. And then after you finish this, why, you share it with somebody. And this is when we closely examine these things with these basic instincts in mind, seeing where these were threatened and why. And we closely examine this inventory with the sponsor. And at that same time, we go over each item in the inventory and get an answer. And the answers are in the book. Either write a letter to somebody that's died, share all of the things you always wanted to share and never could in the first person, and then go some quiet place and read it out loud. And when you're finished, burn it. I sponsored a little gal from the Venice, California area, and she came out and she spent an hour and a half at her father's grave at Marchfield in Riverside reading those letters that she had written, and she was set free. If there's somebody that you just can't do anything about, the prayer is on page 552. It's also on the last page of this deal. And you can put as many names as you want to in there. I had a guy do such damage to me and my family that I'm fully capable of first-degree premeditated murder, drunk or sober, doesn't matter if you do damage to me or my family. I had to use that prayer for 2 years, not 2 weeks. At the end of 2 years, I met this guy at a party and I said, "How are you?" And I checked inside and there was nothing. From first-degree premeditated murder to nothing. And then he started to tell me how he was, and I said, "You know, I really don't give a damn." And I checked inside again, and there was nothing. And so, with the sponsor that you're sharing this, we find out whether we need to make an amend, whether we need to put him in the prayer, whether we need to write a letter. What solution is there for this? Okay? And sometimes, see, we only get to change things in this life or accept them. We don't get to complain about them anymore. So once I hear about the problem, I don't want to hear about it ever again. I just want to hear about the solution. Okay? And then now we share that and immediately go to step 6 and 7. I just don't understand these. "Well, we're having a discussion group on step 6 tonight." It's one paragraph. How long can you discuss getting ready to pray? You know, Bill only put that step in there as a transition between reading it and getting on your knees. It was a filler. You know, I mean, if you're standing in the gates ready and the counter's down for a downhill race, I mean, you suppose you'd, "Oh, excuse me, I'm praying for the willingness." I mean, when they say go, you're out of there. When the jump master says go, you know, you're out the plane. At any time for that business. Willingness is demonstrated by action. So get down on your knees and say the prayer for step 7, and it's right there in the book, and I can't remember what page it's on. Yeah, so thank you, 76. And just do it. That's all. And now it's taken care of. The secret to happiness, as I have on the bottom of that first page, is keeping current with our feelings. If we are current with our feelings, nothing's piled up in us, something comes along, and I like to look at problems as a little inconvenience. I mean, that heart surgery and all of that was really damned inconvenient. See? But that's really all it was. And if you look back on last year and try to remember what monumental emergency you're driving across town 100 miles an hour to take care of, I guarantee by God to you, you can't even remember it. And there's another thing that we cannot recall. We can recall and re-experience every single emotion in the world except pain. We cannot re-experience pain. But sadness and melancholy and happiness and joy, we can recreate that over and over. And yeah, I just can get high as a kite on gratitude. It's incredible. And so now you're finished with the inventory, and you're finished with 6 and 7. You already have your list from step 4, and there is a lot of noise in these steps if you're busy. There's the noise of the writing in step 4. There's the noise of sharing in step 5. There's the noise of the prayer in step 7. There's the noise of the pencil some more, maybe. There's the noise of knocking on the doors while you're making those amends. So if you're not making any noise, you aren't doing nothing. And that's bad English, and so is your program. You're not doing anything unless you're making noise, okay? And then you end up stuck in step 10, 11, and 12 for the rest of your life. And I like to look at the 12 steps as a great big slide like this with a big loop at the bottom, okay? And now less than a day has passed and you're already down here to step 9. And then what we have is step 10, 11, and 12 like this. And I've rewritten step 12 to read an interesting way. You understand that in the appendix it says, having had a spiritual awakening. Excuse me a minute. Having had a spiritual awakening. Now, back in the appendix under spiritual awakening, it's defined as a personality change sufficient to recover from the disease of alcoholism. So the way I look at step 12 today is, having had a personality change as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message of how our personality changed to the alcoholic and practice these principles of steps 10, 11, and 12 in our daily lives so that we can ensure that our personality will continue to change and that we never, ever have to drink again as long as we live. Because my book says that as long as we are practicing the principles in our daily affairs and trying to keep our spiritual house in order, we need never fear drinking again as long as we live. What are the principles? The principles. Bill defines it. Okay? He says in step 5 that the principles that we have laid down are a guide to spiritual progress, right? So a guide can't be words. And you'll see this cockamamie list that they give. Probably got one up at the Serenity Shop there about the principles of honesty and, you know. Then they got 12 of them. Isn't that neat? The principles are the same as they are in making a car or an airplane run. I got to pre-flight an airplane every time to make sure that all the principles are in place or it's going to crash at the end of the runway. You know, and then I got to make sure everything's working in concert. So the principles are continuing to take personal inventory, steps 4, 5, 6, and 7, and when we're wrong, promptly admitting it, steps 8 and 9. And so in step 10, we have steps 4 through 9. And so what we put down here is exactly out of the book. At the end of each day, we go over our day looking to see if we've been selfish, self-centered, inconsiderate, or dishonest. And if you have been, write it. And I know the book doesn't say, well, we have to write the 10th step. Well, Bill felt he had a third grade education, and so the analogy I use with these pukes I sponsor is, let me ask you, dummy, if you had a job in a warehouse and the boss came along and he said, "My, you're doing a wonderful job, please continue your inventory." Now, if you throw the pencil away, you've thrown your job away. And besides that, there's a magic that happens between the pencil and the paper that will never, ever, ever happen between the mind and the mouth. And I don't know why that is, and I don't care, because I think knowing why is the booby prize of life.
Well, why did it happen? I must have gotten a flat tire because it's God's will.
No, you're driving around on nails with a bald tire. God does not wake up in the morning and think, "I'm going to screw Ted today." That's my job. And I'm good at it. I'm an expert at creating chaos in my own life. All I got to do is start thinking. So in step 9-10, we have the principles of all of steps 4 through 9. Any question? Anybody? Everybody thoroughly intimidated. In step 11, okay, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for His thinking for us, because that's what it says in the book, and the power to carry that out. And so we got all the power back in step 11 in a different form. Power to carry that out. And in step 11 it says, you know, if we're confused and we don't know what to do during the day, it says that we stop and we take as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful. We ask for the right thought or action. And so at the bottom of page 87 is the thought and action that is equal to will and life. Any question about that? It just makes it so much easier. Thought and action. We constantly remind ourselves that we're no longer running the show. Now, the steps 10 and 11 are kind of mixed up in the big book. I forgot to bring my big book, which has got it all marked, but where's step 10 start?
Page 84.
This brings us to step 10. Over on page 85 in the middle paragraph is easy to let up on this spiritual program. That's really part of step 11. Then over on page 86, the bottom paragraph on awakening, let us think about our... Wait a minute. At the top of 86, when we retire at night, that entire paragraph is really step 10. So step 11 really starts on the bottom paragraph on page 86. When we awaken to the... Let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Okay, so again, this form where it says, at night, make a list of the things you want to do tomorrow. Those are your plans for the day. Then in the next morning, after a little exercise and some prayer and meditation, then go over the list of the things. Those are your plans that you're going to consider. So this is in exact conformance with the program, okay? I mean, you can't do anything if you don't have a plan. This other item here about making a list at night of 10 things that you did during the day that you feel good about, this is a real serious thing. One of the biggest problems with alcoholics is lack of self-esteem. And if you write something on that list, own it. Like before I left the house this morning, I made my bed and cleaned up the bedroom and cleaned up the kitchen. And as I was leaving, I looked back and I said, you know, I'm glad I did that. I feel good about that. And what happens is our behavior starts to change. If you make that list every night, subconsciously, after you've done that for about 2 weeks, your subconscious will start thinking about things to put on that list that night. And all of a sudden you'll let some boob in on the freeway in front of you instead of ramming him into the divider rail. You know. Or you'll pull your lady's chair out for her or open the door for her, and you put that on your list. And our behavior starts to change subconsciously. So it's an incredible exercise, and we will begin to feel better about ourselves. So these are the principles right here. In the morning, in the evening, step 10. And during the day, if any amends are necessary, 11 in the morning, and all during the day, it says, asking for an intuitive thought or whatever. And that is continuing to change our personality by continuing to take the inventory and all of that. So the whole thing really works in a circle. So that's the way that looks. Now I'm going to show you something that I've never seen before. Fascinated by it. And that's the grief curve, and you might want to write all of this down. And this is really interesting to look at when a problem happens. Over here we've got threat or damage to a basic instinct. I haven't gotten anybody that can put this into a computer and draw me a diagram of it yet, and if somebody can, why, I'd appreciate the help. And right here we give... we give the power away. Right here is when we give the power away. Once we give the power away, we have to enter the grief curve. The first part of the grief curve is denial. Can you ready to read this, all right? There's a little box up here called shock. A gal came up to me at my old Palos Verdes meeting, and her daughter had just been cut in half by an outboard motor up at Lake Tahoe. And I said, "Well, you really need some serious help." And I said, "I'm here for you." "Oh, no," she said, "I'm into acceptance." That's the way it was. 2 days had passed, right? Where she was shock. 2 weeks later, she was drunk. Because she didn't realize that you have to process this. We got anger. We got fear. We got guilt. Down here we got depression. And suicide's always an option. So it goes over here. I love the Al-Anon that showed me how to commit suicide. She was going to hurl herself in front of a parked car, but she thought she might wreck her dress. So what she decided to do was fill a whole bathtub full of body conditioner and climb in there and soften herself to death. My kind of suicide. Coming up the upside, we've got admission over here. We've got acceptance over here, and you can put as many different feelings as you want in here, and freedom up here. And we've got another little box up here. Now, this distance between here and here, over here, is a function of time. In the case of the death of a loved one, this distance from here to here is half the time of the emotional involvement. So a lot of people do not live long enough to get over it. This distance, the depth of the curve here, from here to here, is a function of emotional involvement. Let's look at how it happens. Let's look at a dented finger. Yes, please. The depth of the curve is a function of emotional involvement. Yes. Normally, the time between denial and working through the whole curve to freedom from the pain is one half the length of the time of the emotional involvement. Now, that is not to say that somebody that's been married for 20 years and their wife dies is going to take 10 years to get over it. They may not have been emotionally involved for 20 years. But if their girlfriend dies, actually, it's the time that you're vitally concerned about this person. Now, let's look at it. Let's take a lady with a broken fingernail. Now, first is shock. And then denial. It's good to happen. I just had them done, right? If I only hadn't had to move that table for that drunk, you know, now what am I going to do about it? There may be fear in there of what are other people going to think and all of that. We got threat and damage big time to the whole deal here. Guilt, you know. Well, if I had to spend all that money, I wouldn't be so pissed off, you know. This is depressing. Oh, well, I'll go ahead and get it fixed. Screw it. On the other hand, if they have sparkles all over them and you're deeply emotionally involved with these fingernails, the curve's going to look like this. It's going to be real short distance between what the happening and recovery, but it's going to be real deep. A guy with a car, he gets the fender dented, all right? Shock, denial, anger, fear. God, if I'd left a little earlier, it wouldn't have happened. This is really depressing. Look at how screwed up my car is. Oh, I'll call my insurance agent and screw it, right? However, if it's an antique car and he's really emotionally involved with it, that's going to be a real deep curve. He's going to get through it in a big hot hurry. You know, you hit your finger with a hammer and it'll just be a little curve like that. Probably lasts a day. So it's always a function of emotional involvement as to how deep that curve is and how long it's going to last. Any questions? Yeah.
What does another box?
I haven't gotten there yet. So, threat or damage to one of the basic instincts immediately forces us into the grief curve, and we have no choice. Or do we? Do I have to give the power away? See, do I have to? How important is that dented fender? Do I have to get in a rage and get all of my endorphins going and, you know, get all red in the face over it and throw a hammer through the wall and, you know. So if I can take that second that it says in the big book in step 11, when agitated or doubtful, we ask for the right thought or action. Now, this is really agitating, having the front end fall off of my car at 90 miles an hour. We got a choice there. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes we just react. But now look what happens. And here is where the magic formula of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've never seen this applied by anybody, so I've copyrighted it. Look at this. We go from here over to here with step 4. And it may be bent. It may be straight line. We can short-circuit all of this pain in the grief curve by picking up that 900-pound pencil and writing about it, and then, by God, getting on the phone and sharing it with somebody, and then asking God to help us with it in 5, 6, and 7. And we got rid of it for God's sake, and we don't have to bury it inside and keep, "Oh, that son of a bitch, you know, blah, blah, reliving all this thing like this all the time. I run over him the next time I see him." Putting him in our prayer on page 552 over here, okay?
"I'm sorry, I should have left the house."
You can't should have done anything in this life. God, that word ought to be taken out of the damn dictionary. I called a reserve a plane, I don't know, some time ago, and this little snip gets on the phone. She says, "Well, Mr. Harbach, it's Friday." I said, "I didn't call for a date." "I suppose it was raining, you'd give me a weather report." "Did I want to reserve an airplane?" She says, "Well, they're all reserved. You should have called on Wednesday." I said, "Fine, how do you do that?" She says, "What do you mean?" I said, "Is this Earth?" I said, "You told me in order to get a plane, I should have called on Wednesday, and I want to know exactly how to do that. Because I want to reserve a plane. So I need to know how do you should have called on Wednesday to reserve one." She said, "Well, I don't understand. That's not what I..." I said, "Wait a minute. Did you not say exactly that if I wanted a plane, I should have called on..." "Isn't that what you said?" She said, "Well, yes, but..." I said, "No, yes, but with me. That's what the kids I do that I sponsor say." I made her crazy. You can't should have done anything in this life, you know. So the next time some guy starts with you with, "You should have..." "Well, I would have if I could have, like, you know." See, all except won't. People say, "Well, I won't work the steps." Oh, that's acceptable. But can't work them is not acceptable. Okay. Up here, we've got 8 and 9. We need to make amends. All right? And now, in order to stay free with this whole thing and really put it in action, we have another plan ahead thing here. 10, 11, and 12. Okay? And this is how the formula of the program works. And you can take any problem that you've got and insert it into this formula, and freedom, which is the answer that we're looking for, happens. It may take time, but it's not going to take anywhere near the length of time that it will somebody that's going to stay over here
and come to meetings and share. And share again.
There's a guy over in West Los Angeles, I guarantee you, I could go over there and he's staring the same thing that he was 24 years ago on the first meeting that I went to. Hadn't done a damn thing except he's so dry as a fire hazard. Honest to God, the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous have become garbage dumps. If all of that talk worked, we wouldn't need the program, would we?
Therapy would work. Recovery centers would be turning out winners
instead of turning them over to AA. We've got the only formula in 2,000 years that works. But like any formula, if you don't follow the formula and put the necessary information in it, you're not going to get the answer. You know, you take the Pythagorean theorem, which says if I square this side and this side and add them together and take the square root, I got the length of the hypotenuse. If I put a cube in here, guess what? And if I don't put anything in there, guess what? Nothing. And that's what, you know, I was at a meeting some time ago, and this woman says,
Oh, God, I'm just so furious. My hat ate my cat ate my canary. I said, perfect. God, you got a perfectly sane and normal cat. Did exactly what it's programmed for. Eat birds. Put a bulletproof sign on your next canary saying, don't eat. You got a perfectly normal cat. What in the hell is your problem? Did you let the canary out? Well, yes, but no, don't do that. I don't want to hear that crap at an AA meeting. I hear about the cat ate the canary, and by God, I wrote about it, and I shared it with my sponsor, and asked God to help me with it, and God and I went out and buried the canary, and I'm not going to open the cage anymore. You know, I just don't want to hear all of that stuff.
Oh, I have a burning desire.
I don't go to discussion meetings, really. I either end up with 15 people to sponsor or everybody's in a rage at me, so... Either way, I lose. We got a lot of stuff written up here. Does anybody have any question on it or miss any part of it? Can you see how a threat or a damage to one of these basic instincts as described in step 4 in the 12 and 12, you should really tear step 4 out of the 12 and 12 and staple it together and throw the rest of the book away. Because it's a real fishing trip. There isn't any how-to anything in that book. Well, what I think it says is, screw it. Any question on this? So you can see how a threat or damage, if we give the power away, you know, think about the red light coming on behind you when you're driving. Immediately, the cop has all the power. And here we are. Oh, God, you know, going to jail is depressing, you know. The boss calls you into the office, you know. So, if we choose to give the power to whatever it is that is threatening or damaging us, we're in here. And you better have a big pencil and paper handy if you don't want to get into this whole thing. All I'm saying is this may be way down here, but by God, it's a lot shorter than this distance. Now, if you are in the grief curve and you're grieving over something, and you're seriously grieving over something, like the loss of a canary that your cat's eaten, why, the way this moves is not in a straight line, unfortunately. The way it moves is this way. But each time it comes back up here, it doesn't go as high. It doesn't have the power that it had before. And each time it comes back up here, it doesn't last as long. And each time that it comes back up here, we write about it again and again and again. Praying for acceptance if it's something we can't change. Praying for the courage to change it if it's something we can change. Okay? But don't expect it to just go, oh, I'm free. Except in the dented fender. You're still going to remember it, you know. God damn that guy, just, you know. But it won't be as powerful, it won't last as long. But it will wash like this. When we come to, I'm going to erase this. Has everybody got it that needs it? There's an interesting thing about a human being. And again, we're going to look at the same curve. But what we're going to look at it as is just a cup like this. The most important thing about this cup is not its size and not its shape and not its color and not what it's made out of. The most important thing about this is the space within. And that's what a human being is all about. Then the cover doesn't matter and nothing else, okay? And when we first come to Alcoholics Anonymous, this is all frothing and foaming over with guilt, shame, fear, resentment, anger, rage, all that stuff. As we start
to work with the program, what happens is that the cup begins to tip like this, and this stuff begins to spill out. Now what happens is we got some space up here for God's thinking for us for the first time. For the first time. You know, even Jesus Christ got his cup full a lot of times when he threw the money lenders out of the temple. Nobody's perfect. We claim spiritual growth, not spiritual perfection, okay? And the one day that you get it upside down, goodbye. You'll probably be ready to resurrect. And if you do think that it's upside down one day and you're just perfectly serene, everything's wonderful, hang on. I think it was Angel here that gave me a new deal not too long ago. She said, in Alcoholics Anonymous, first it gets good, and then it gets bad, and then it gets different, and then it gets real different, and then it gets real. So be careful of praying for serenity, and remember that this is what we are trying to do, is keep that cup as empty as possible. Any questions on how to get through the steps that fast or anything else? You doing okay? The page after this diagram are just some glossary of words for step 4 and 5, just for information. On this page of feelings that I've got,
maybe at a meeting on feelings.
The reason is that this is in here is so that we can better describe how we feel. And so if you're feeling uncomfortable or irritable, look at this and ask yourself what it is you're really feeling. Okay? And men have a terrible time with feeling. This daily inventory, this sheet here, this is the road we're kind of traveling down the middle. You hear people say, well, the road gets narrower. Let me tell you, nobody's out changing the geography. What happens is we become more sensitive to the negatives in our life. And we have no anesthetic to overcome them, okay? So when we become angry, we're sensitive to it almost immediately, whereas before we possibly weren't. In the 7-step prayer, instead of asking God to remove these character defects, what I ask for, because I'm a pretty positive guy, I ask for the power to do whatever's necessary so that I can become more giving and sharing, and then I won't have to worry about greed, okay? That I can become more considerate, and then I don't have to be inconsiderate. I had to pray for a long time for the power to drive 62 miles an hour, because I love to drive 94. If I'm thinking about, you know, remove the urge to drive 94, I'm going to be thinking 94 all of the time, getting a lot of tickets. So if you can get the strength to turn that coin over on the other side as a positive answer, okay? So we can pray for the power to do whatever is necessary, that so we can become more interested in others and we will not be self-seeking. The negative will disappear if we concentrate on the positive. Okay? Any questions? This works a lot faster, a lot easier, and a lot better. I was talking about emotions, and here again in the program I had written down something about relationships, and the biggest problem in relationships is that women
uh-oh.
And men over here, are logic based. They're deductive, analytical, and the woman primarily is operating out of her right brain. And the right brain is where everything is, that's creative is, the art, the music, all of that stuff, the real creative stuff. Men primarily are left brain. So the woman says, I don't have enough money in the bank. Now he wants to fix it, right? Why not? I don't know why, I just, you know. And then he goes to work and tries to explain to her how to balance a checkbook. She doesn't want to know about balancing a goddamn checkbook. All she wants to know is she doesn't have enough money. And so we try to fix it with logic, and they get angry, and they screw you, and then, we, you know, and the whole thing gets all screwed up. Because we're operating on out of two different sides of the brain. Now, an ideal person, if there is such thing, is equally balanced. Okay? But there are very few of those. Also, there are men that are completely right-brained. Those are the architects and the artists and the great chefs and all of this stuff. The real creative people. You talk to them about balancing a checkbook and they get all crazy. There are a lot of women that are left-brained and they're in business. They're out there in the concrete world doing it. So the important thing to do is to figure out who it is you're dealing with. Is my partner in my relationship right or left-brained? If you're both left-brained or both right-brained, no problem. You can both cry and talk about emotions and wallow around and all the rest of that stuff, never figure anything out. But you'll have fun! You know. If you're both left-brained, you can sit there with slide rules and calculators and computers and all that crap, figure out everything, and not do anything. You not have any fun. Because it will cost too much. Okay? So we don't have too many ideals, but the thing to do is figure out who your partner is, whether left-brained or right-brained. And then here's how the conversation goes. It's really neat. Let's just assume that the logic is practical here and that the male is left-brained in the example and the female is right-brained. He says, I think that we ought to go out for dinner and a movie. And then if he's a real gentleman, he says, how do you feel? She says, I feel like staying home and ordering a pizza. What do you think? He says, I think I'll go out and get the pizza and bring home a movie. How do you feel about that? She says, great. She is not forced over into the left side of her brain. He's not forced into the right side of his brain. And there's no confusion. But what we try to do, usually, when she says this, is we say, well, I think that we ought to do that, and here's why, and you're all screwed up, and I got some energy, you know, and trying to fix her, for Christ's sake. You know, and not taking into account the fact that she's emotionally based, and emotions and logic are never, ever compatible.
You know, if I'm flying an airplane and I get vertigo, this is emotional. Sure, it's caused by a physical trauma, but it's emotional. And my emotions, everything that I feel inside is going to tell me I'm upside down. And I don't care what the instruments say. Screw them. Unplug all the red lights, you know. I know I'm upside down, right? So, this is the basic problem in relationships, is that we've never been taught how to actually communicate. Never been taught how to take into consideration what's going on in the other human being, for God's sake. And the guy tries to attack the thing with logic, which makes the woman crazy. The woman tries to explain her emotions, which makes the man crazy. Because you ask a man how he feels about something, and he's going to tell you how he thinks. Well, I think I feel pissed off. See? And you just can't communicate. Is this comfortable with everybody? I mean, can you see how screwed up it all gets? However, if we get into one of these goddamn things and we can stop for that instant praying for guidance and sharing this with the person that we're with and say, well, you know, I'm really being self-centered and inconsiderate and dishonest. I really didn't have the money to take you out to dinner anyway. I thought it'd be a big deal. You know, and if we can now look at the program working backwards, which is really interesting, okay? Because we got to, not only do we have a formula to get us out of all of this turmoil, but we also have the same formula to keep us from going into it. See, when I'm going to land a plane, I've always got to ask myself, how do I look? See, here's a field here, and I got to ask myself, am I too high or too low? Ideally, I'm 1,000 feet above in landing pattern, above the apron, okay? Am I too high or am I too low? Am I too fast or am I too slow on my approach? Am I too long back here or am I too short? If I'm too high or too low, too fast or too slow, too long or too short, and I try to land that plane, I get to die. Because there's not going to be enough run out for that plane. So the same thing in the program. We're about to do something, we're about to say something, we're about to get involved in a deal. Doesn't matter what it is, go out to dinner. Ask myself, how do I look? Okay? Am I being selfish, self-centered, dishonest? Inconsiderate? However. Is it going to be harmful? I'm looking at those character defects, okay? Is it going to harm anybody? If I go ahead and do this, and I have to go back and do a damned inventory on it after I've screwed them up? See? Am I going to have to make an amends for it later? Am I going to have to write an inventory and talk to my sponsor? So is it selfish, self-centered, dishonest, inconsiderate? Is it going to create some fear here? What kind of thing are we talking about? And if I can answer those questions, no, it looks okay. Then, according to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's probably okay to go ahead with the deal. See? So the program then begins to start working backwards. And we look at the character defects as a guideline for whatever we're going to get into. Does anybody have any questions or anything they'd like to share? We've been going an hour and a half. Again, the last page on this package is the prayer on page 152. And believe me, that has a power of healing that is unbelievable. So if you've got a resentment against somebody and you just can't solve it, put them in that prayer. You can put 20 people in that, but there's no limit on it. Put as many people as you have names that you can't solve the resentment. Put them in that prayer. And if you do it every day for 2 years, you'll be okay. Does anybody have any question, anything they'd like to add? Or cause it seems like everybody needs to have coffee and, yes. You have to ask Walt. He'll be... you'll have to see Dick. You'll have to see Dick Bowlby or one of the other people that had them coffeed. I don't have any more coffees. Yes. No, she was just asking about that. You'll have to ask one of the hosts or something to see. So I'll leave my master here, and I thought he'd get about 100 printed. Anybody else have a question? Yes, Al.
I have a flyer for Big Book if anybody wants
to. Oh, great. The Big Book Comes Alive seminar, he's got flyers, that's Joe and Charlie, and I really recommend it. A lot of my material comes from there, and I give them all the credit in the world for it. Yes. About what? Okay, I'll answer. Do you think everybody would enjoy hearing it, or was it? Did everybody enjoy this today? I really had a good time doing it, and I appreciate everybody coming. And believe me, if you follow this program the way it was laid out, it'll help you in sponsoring, and we'll see a lot better recovery with people really getting in and doing it. So thanks a million.
Thank you.